At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
I'm Adam Mischewski, welcoming you to the Surely You Can't Be Serious podcast. Join your hosts, Jason and Dee, as they dive deep into two iconic albums from 1985. Are they hair metal? Are they glam metal? Or are they heavy metal? Label them what you will, these are two of my all-time favorites. I can't choose a winner, but perhaps Jason and Dee can settle the score. So kick back, relive the memories, and enjoy the ride.
Gosh, Dee, it's been 2 weeks since we've been together in the studio, and we come back here, I look around, we got a rat infestation today.
Welcome back to the Surely You Can't Be Serious podcast, everybody. To all your Shirley fans out there, I know that loving us is a dirty job, but we're glad you're the ones to do it.
Hey, we're going to go round and round with Rat today.
The hits will just keep on coming, won't they? Okay, before we start going, we got to give a shout out to our executive producers. We have a couple new ones.
Yeah, we do. We got a couple new ones. We got Omar Gabi. We've got Matthew Brent. And we've got Tom.
Tom, who I'm pretty sure has got to be the Tom that commented on our Dire Straits episode and gave us the intel on the Neve soundboard. If it's not you, Tom, thank you to the Tom that joined, both of you.
That's right.
But thank you guys so much. If you want to be an executive producer of one of our episodes, just go over to patreon.com/Shirley Podcast and you can join for as little as $5 a month. You become an executive producer of an episode.
And I will tell you this, Matthew Brent.
Yeah.
He's friends with Dirk Smith.
Oh yeah. Dirk, who came on and did I won't give it away, but did one of those special Patreon episodes with you. That's right.
He did. And Matthew, I guess, bought him a Patreon subscription as a gift.
It's the gift that keeps on giving, Clark.
And so Matthew has actually helped us like 2 times the amount. So
yes. So if you want to be a member of the Jelly of the Month Club, the Shirley of the Month Club, do like Matthew did for Dirk and join up, join your buddies up. And come join all the fun that we have.
You might get invited to be on, do a podcast with us.
Yeah.
I mean, let's go back to the Sunset Strip in the early 80s.
The LA scene where everything was leather and silicone implants and cleavage for miles and miles.
Sleazy babes and dirty rock riffs.
You know, it's funny because we've done now multiple bands from this scene, right?
Sure,
you know, we got Motley Crue, we got Van Halen.
Did Poison.
Poison. I mean, so many bands that were doing this LA scene, Guns N' Roses. And it seems like the story is kind of the same. Like everybody that was there had one shitty apartment that the whole band lived in, and every time the show was done, everybody would come back to that little hole, that rat infested hole, and party with the band until the sun broke through on the dawn.
Absolutely. The Rat Mansion West. We're going to talk about that today, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So what's our comparison this week and next week?
So it's kind of weird because we're kind of comparing bands that have a lot of incest going on between them, really. I mean, like 2/3 of this band played for Dokken at some point.
It's crazy.
And so why not? They both had big albums in 1985. We're going to compare Invasion of Your Privacy to Dokken.
Under Lock and Key.
Under Lock and Key.
It's going to be great, man. These are crunchy, pop-friendly rock riffs that are a bit grimy, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's going to be fun to kind of get down and dirty with these.
So just for all of our audience out there, I was not super familiar with either one of these albums. This album we're covering today, Rat, I at least know the hits that came off of this album. Dokken, I got nothing. I have no source, no frame of reference. And so sometimes that can be a bad thing, like Rambo.
You missed the moment.
Yeah, I did. But then when we did The Cult, I absolutely loved that album. Had never heard that album before. And at this point, I still haven't heard Under Lock and Key. I don't know if I'm going to like it or not, but I'm ready to go. And for Rat, I got to listen to the whole album instead of just the hits. And so I'm excited to talk about it, see how we got here.
Well, before we dive into it, you touched on something there. You know, we did talk about the Cult last summer,
mm-hmm.
and we mashed it up with Great White,
mm-hmm.
who was another dirty, grimy LA band from
LA
the
Sunset
scene.
Strip. Yeah,
that's right. So let's get into it.
Okay.
Rat, Invasion of Your Privacy.
Here we go. Track one.
You're in Love.
So right out of the gate, I'm getting some really heavy Eddie Van Halen, Ain't Talking About Love vibes going on from this one. Love the strong, full, punchy guitar.
Yeah, I think you can definitely feel the Van Halen influence. I don't think they would shy away from that at all.
No, I mean, it was their inspiration for moving to L.A. Like, this was a San Diego band initially, and they were doing great on the San Diego scene. And then Stephen Piercy and Robin Crosby decided to go up to L.A. and listen to this band called Van Halen. And, I mean, they're still playing in the Troubadour back then, but he said they were playing as though they were playing for an arena full of people. Like huge speakers, David Lee Roth jumping off of the speakers. I mean, they said, we got to get up here and do this too.
Van Halen, one of the most influential bands of all time, basically gave birth to all these hair metal bands from the LA Strip.
Absolutely.
Have you seen the video for You're in Love?
No, I have not.
Okay. I've got to show this to you because the introduction clip is so funny because it has a familiar face. Let me know when you recognize this a character who's a very prominent 80s person.
Okay.
Are you in love with him and not with me?
I guess I am, George.
You're gonna marry him?
Oh, wait a minute. I can handle this proposal from now, son. Kid, you really mean that?
You haven't asked me anything yet.
I wonder if I said the wrong thing.
You recognize that guy?
Yes, Mr. Ronald Reagan.
Mr. Ronald Reagan. That comes from a movie that I've seen two movies listed.
Uh-huh.
That intro clip where he's like, are you saying you're in love with him and not with me?
Yeah.
Could be from a movie called Santa Fe Trail from 1940.
Okay.
Or from Brother Rat.
Ah, well.
1938.
Gotcha.
Pretty interesting to see good old Ronnie.
Yeah, I mean, right at the height of the Reagan era, too.
Yeah, no
1985.
Doubt. 85, man. So I don't know if you've heard the story behind this particular song.
Lay it on me.
Okay, so the producer for this album is a guy named Bo Hill.
Yeah.
Bo Hill produced Out of the Cellar, which came out the prior year.
Mm-hmm.
Out of the Cellar has Wanted Man, Lack of Communication. I mean, their biggest song, their signature song,
right.
Round and Round.
Right.
So Bo Hill was brought back in as producer. Now, they didn't really get along so well with him.
He ran a tight ship, and this is not a tight ship kind of band.
Yeah, you know, I heard him talk about that. He said, so we'll talk about Warren DeMartini and his youth. I mean, he's 20, 21 or so when this album comes out.
Yeah, joined the band at 18.
Yeah, basically overnight.
Yeah.
So Bo Hill was like, you know, he knew what the budget was. He said Warren kind of had this image that he had a suitcase full of cash, and then whatever he didn't spend, he got to keep.
Uh-huh.
He's like, I just like kept track of the receipts and like they would reimburse, you know, the Rat Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, they had it all wrong, but it was always concerned about budget.
Yeah.
Okay. But Doug Morris was the president of Atlantic Records.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And Bo Hill was kind of his friend, kind of his go-to guy.
Yeah.
And was really good at keeping bands on track and on budget. And he said that when he called after they had kind of put all these songs out, Doug Morris was like, so what song do you think should be the lead track? Bo Hill's like, I mean, it's clear. It's Lay It Down. It's the best song in the album. And Doug Morris goes, I think it's going to be You're in Love. And he said Bo Hill was like devastated. He's like, we got to come out with our best foot forward on this one.
Yeah.
And Doug said, you're overruled. Right?
Yeah.
But here's the interesting thing. I can't find any evidence that that was actually the case. Bo Hill was recalling the story.
Yeah.
But I think that Lay It Down was the first video released.
Okay. Well, so it's interesting. You know, we text each other and call each other as we're preparing for these episodes. And you were telling me about Bo Hill. And you were like, he was with this band called Shanghai. And you gave me the story about, you know, they had one album and it didn't sell any, right?
He said it sold exactly zero copies.
So I was like, man, I know I've heard of Shanghai the band before. Somehow it's come up in the last 6 years of researching music. Shanghai the band has come up before. And so just a few minutes after our phone conversation, I sent you a text, and Bo Hill was the keyboardist that came in and took over when they changed the band's name to Shanghai, but he took over for someone named Holly Knight, who we've talked about a gajillion times because she's written so many incredible hits, lots of pop hits.
Oh, absolutely.
Milli Vanilli, Blame It on the Rain, among many others. So I was like, I knew I'd heard Shanghai before. So he was keyboardist for them, but he had also already started producing at this point. And obviously a good producer. All of these songs have a similar sound and that I would call the Bo Hill sound. But talking about Warren DeMartini, like when they first got together and started the recording process, he had no idea about how different things were, and he couldn't find the right sound for his guitar. And the sound for the guitar is huge. Like, you can't just only be a great player, which he absolutely is. I mean, unsung guitar god.
Guitar god.
And how is he not more talked about? I mean, with a name like DeMartini, that's a fantastic name.
Yeah, it is.
How do you know? But anyway, he comes in and they've got these Marshall half stacks that are huge, ready to go, but it doesn't sound right. And he's like, I just wish it could kind of sound like my practice amp at home. And he's like, well, bring it over. And he's right. Like, you could do that? You could just put the practice amp in the recording studio? He's like, yeah. So they literally take the amp for the practice amp and they hook it to the speakers, the larger cabinet speakers that they're using. And that's how you find his signature sound on all these albums.
That's great. Yeah. That's great. You know, I heard Bo Hill tell a story. So Bo was constantly at odds with the guys in Rat.
Right.
He said, first of all, every one of them thought they were great songwriters. Mm-hmm. And so they would bring in all these songs, and everybody, of course, wanted their two or three songs on the album. Well, Bo had to kind of make the list and say, these are our best. These are not going to make it. These are going to make it. And so he said, at all times, at least two out of the five were just over the top pissed at him all the time, 100%
right.
of the time.
Right.
But he also would get in trouble because he said one time they left, they had to take a break to go on tour. Like, they got this opportunity to go to Japan and tour. Mm-hmm. And so he's left working with the track, and he's mixing, and he's like, gosh, I really need Warren to play another D chord. And he's like, he looked over and he's like, well, there's Warren's guitar. And I'm here.
Yeah.
He's like, I'm not a great guitar player, but I can play a D chord.
You can play a D chord.
Right. So he's like, so he went up and was like, oh. And then they were like, you dare to play his stuff on the out? And so they were just like always mad at him for something. I did watch this video.
Yeah.
In the era of hair bands and, you know, showing babes and, you know, showing rock, and you know, I mean, you're struck by lightning is one of the lyrics in this, right? Mm-hmm. You only live to have fun. They're advertising their brand of fun rock here, right?
Debauchery.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Debauchery. Yeah. Yes. But in the video, there's a girl holding up a sign that says, eat me, I'm cheese. That's what we're dealing with here.
Is this the one where, like, Robin Crosby pulls off a bra or something that somebody has thrown at him?
Probably.
Okay.
Probably. Right. In this video, so you've got the Ronald Reagan clip at the beginning.
Yep.
You've got a clip featuring Betty Boop,
okay,
Buster Keaton, Mickey Rooney, Frank Sinatra, Lucy, like I Love Lucy, mm-hmm, Bob Hope, and then you have the kind of infamous clip from E.T., where Elliot is like, and Erica Eleniak are like, he's getting ready to kiss her, and he's releasing the frogs, and he's learning how to, like, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, the kissing E.T. scene. Is watching the romantic
watching
scene on
that
the
movie.
TV.
Yes.
And it's getting translated to Elliot at the school, yes.
That clip is in this video. It's not by lightning.
So either this was an absolute licensing nightmare, or they just used all that stuff without permission. And I'm going with probably option number two.
It's possible.
Yeah.
And of course, at the very end,
yeah,
you have a clip between Groucho Marx and a smoking hot Marilyn Monroe when she's still a redhead.
The little Norma Jean Playboy days. That will not be the last time that Playboy comes up in this episode.
Yes. All right, I love this song. What a great song to kick off with.
Great opening track. Yeah. I agree. I don't know that it's the first single you released, but it is definitely a fantastic opening track.
Next song?
Yeah, let's do it.
Next song in the album is called Never Use Love.
Okay, another fantastic, killer, crunchy guitar opening. The great thing about this is that you really get to hear the two guitars going of Robin Crosby and Warren DeMartini at the same time, you know, kind of answering each other back and forth with this. Now, you know, we talked just a bit ago about Robin and Steven really being the originators of this band. And several of the band members, and we'll talk about it in a minute, played with other bands, including Dokken.
Yes.
And ultimately they get their lineup together, but their lineup includes Robin and another guitarist named Jake E. Lee as the other guitarist, right?
Yeah.
Now, Jake E. Lee was a little bit older than Warren DeMartini. And at the time that Rat is just about to hit it big, like they're really just about to go big, Jake gets this opportunity that you just can't say no to.
So he gets an opportunity to replace Randy Rhoads in Ozzy Osbourne's band.
Yeah, so go back, check out our No More Tears episode to hear the Randy Rhoads tragedy story. But obviously, Ozzy's in full tilt when that event occurs, and so he needs a replacement guitarist.
Right, so Jake E. Lee goes and auditions for Ozzy's band.
Yep.
And you know who else is there besides every other guitar player in town? Is George Lynch.
George Lynch, the guitarist for Dokken.
And George Lynch said that he really felt like he did well in the audition, felt like he killed it. He felt like he was kind of the leader in the clubhouse. And he said he was standing there and he was talking to Jake E. Lee and they were just kind of conversing about their audition or whatever. And he said Ozzy walked right up to him and said, he turned to Jake E. Lee and he's like, "Do you want the job, mate?" And Jake said, "Yeah, you know," and he's like, "Great, you got it." He's like, "You blew it." Like, kept on walking.
Yeah.
He said George was just like stunned, embarrassed, and devastated.
Yeah.
And he had to take his tail and go back to Dokken.
Good old Ozzy, man.
Yeah.
God rest his soul. He just passed.
We lost him yesterday.
Yesterday, man. That's a tough loss.
By the way.
Yeah.
I got to tell you the story how Robin Crosby got into Rat.
Oh, okay. Yeah, go ahead.
So Stephen Piercy had been in multiple bands, yep. Right? Including, I think, one called Fire Dome, one called Crystal Pistol.
Crystal Pistol with the pistol spelled like with a Y, like Crystal.
Crystal Pistol.
Not subtle.
Right?
Yep.
And so Stephen Piercy's from San Diego. Jake E. Lee's from San Diego. Actually, Warren DeMartini's from San Diego. Well, Robin Crosby's from San Diego, okay? So Robin had been hanging around. He was a guitar player. And he started bugging Jake E. Lee. He's like, "Hey, don't you want this to be a two-guitar band guy?" And Jake's like, "Dude, I think I can handle it."
Yeah.
And he just persisted. And Robin was like, "Hey, listen, you get all the solos, you do whatever, I'll just stand over here, you tell me what to do, I'll do it." And so finally, Jake felt bad for him. He was like, "All right, Robin, you can come in, but you got to do what I say." And he said, as soon as Robin joined the band, he's like, "Okay, now which solo am I getting on this deal?" and just used his leverage to get in there.
And he's 6'5". Built like a brick shit house.
Massive, like a football player with a guitar.
So hard to say no to this guy.
Yes, and while we're there, I mean, do you know who his high school sweetheart was?
Well, she's involved in several of these songs and albums. It's Miss Tawny Catane.
Miss Tawny Catane, back again after we covered her extensively during our Whitesnake episodes.
Another God rest her soul, but so Jake E. Lee is the lead guitarist who's now sharing lead guitar with Robin Crosby. And one of the band names was Mickey Rat.
Mickey Rat.
Mickey Mouse, if you missed the connection there. But Stephen Piercy wanted something more punchy, And taking the cue from Kiss, he just took just the Rat, all capital letters, double letters at the end, you know, it styled it that way, right?
Yep.
But Jake E. Lee gets the job to take over for Randy Rhoads for Ozzy, okay? So they need another guitarist, and they need another guitarist fast. And so Jake E. Lee says, you need to call Warren DeMartini. And they're like, isn't he still in high school? And he's like, no, he graduated last year. He just started junior college,
yes.
Right? So he's living with his mom, going to junior college, and they call him up and they're like, Warren, how'd you like to come play guitar for us? And he's like, okay, let me think about it. I bet I can come next semester as soon as I'm done with my classes. I'll figure out a way to. And they're like, no, tonight. Like, we have a show in 1 week. We need you here tonight. And he's like, guys, I don't even have a place to live. They're like, you can live with Jake. He has got some time before he leaves. You can live with him. You can learn the songs with him. And he's like, can you give me 10 minutes? And they're like, okay, dude. And he hangs up the phone, and his mom is at the grocery store.
Okay.
By the time mom gets home, she encounters him with all of his guitar gear packed into his tiny little car. And she's like, where are you going? It's like, I got invited to join this rock band you've never heard of.
Sorry, Mom. Rock and roll calls. I got to go.
And she's like, I don't think that's a good idea. And he's like, okay, see you later.
That is awesome.
So he goes up there and he lives like tiny little apartment, lives with Jake E. Lee. And he said they would just sit there playing guitar together. But like, you know, Jake E. Lee would teach him some stuff. They would trade some riffs. They would work on their own songs. And he says, I can remember sitting with my back, you know, we're both sitting on the floor. My back is to the couch. His back is to the couch. And I'm playing the beginning of what would become Round and Round, and he's playing the beginning of what would become Bark at the Moon.
That's amazing.
Can you imagine? He's like, you know, you just have no idea as an 18 and whatever, 20-year-old couple of guys that these little riffs that you're playing without the amp. I mean, they're just, you don't want to bug the neighbors, just playing electric guitar without the amp. And it becomes two of the biggest songs of the mid-80s.
No doubt about it. That's incredible. Same little crappy little apartment.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
By the way, do you know anything about Mickey Rat?
No.
Here's what I know about it. Okay. I don't know a lot about it, but apparently it was a comic strip.
Okay.
That looked like Mickey Mouse's, estranged.
It's like a Crumb style.
Down on his luck brother.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Who would do drugs and nail
prostitutes,
other girls, and you know, and it was just kind of this irreverent take on Mickey Mouse.
Gotcha.
And then Stephen Piercy just thought it was hilarious. By the way, the author of Mickey Rat, a guy named Robert Armstrong.
Oh yeah,
coined a term that we use all the time in everyday vernacular.
Yeah.
You know what you call a fat person who lays around and doesn't do anything but watch TV?
Couch potato?
A couch potato. He coined that term, Robert Armstrong.
Fantastic. And he was affiliated with Robert Crumb. Like, they did stuff together. Robert Crumb had all of those kind of X-rated cartoons back in the 70s and stuff. And so it makes total sense that.
There you go. All right. So, I don't know if you know this or not. Warren DeMartini was one of the guys who was actually in Dokken for a moment.
Oh, yeah?
You know, like George Lynch auditions for Ozzy. He leaves. He doesn't call. Just like, oh, we need a guitar player. And so Warren DeMartini's like, well, I can help out. And so he stepped into Dokken for a brief time. A
couple of days.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
These bands are super interlinked.
Yeah.
All right. We ready to hit the next one on the tape?
It's the song you've all been waiting for.
My gosh.
Track number 3, Lay It Down.
This song is incredible.
It's fantastic.
This is a truly special song. I think it's Rat's best song.
Oh, wow. Number one.
Over Round and Round and Way Cool Jr., I'm taking this one.
Nice.
It's my number one draft pick.
I wouldn't argue with you. I mean, I think it's a fantastic song.
It was on my best of 85, our top five of 85 that we did a few months ago.
Well, yes, I learned a little something. Go back and check that episode out. But the kid from Jurassic Park is a younger kid. I guess he's nearly 10 years younger, so he'd been like five, six, maybe, you know? Looks creepy. Looks like creepier than Wednesday Addams creepy.
He got those big bug eyes.
Yeah, it's like dark circles around his eyes. He's actually wearing an actual tuxedo for his birthday
party.
And there's a creepy clown, and then he's making a birthday wish, and it ends up he is seeing into the future where he's, I guess, Stephen Piercy, and the cute little 5-year-old girl next to him is now the Playboy playmate that is on the cover of the album.
Miss Marianne Gravette.
So you sent me a video where she's talking with David Letterman, and I wouldn't describe her as particularly verbal, but she doesn't need to be.
She does not have to be. She could just shut up and walk down the street and stop traffic, literally.
Oh my gosh, yes.
She told a story on Letterman that this guy was driving next to her trying to kind of wave her down. And she was like, huh, what's this guy doing bugging me? And he rear-ended the car in front of him because he wasn't looking.
Yes.
He was staring at her.
Mm-hmm.
And then the guy behind him was looking at her too. And then he smashed into the guy who smashed into the car. Caused a pileup because she is that good looking.
Yeah. So she, I went to her Wikipedia page. Mm. She has been in no less than 20 editions of Playboy. 20. And that does not include Playboy International, which the list is as long as my arm. And yes, she is stunning.
Stunning. Showstopper.
I love that he's like, what do you get for doing this? And she's like, well, I got a Porsche 928 and I got $100,000. And I'm like, would I have gotten naked in 1985 for a Porsche and $100,000?
Sign me up.
Yeah, I would have. Heck yeah.
Let's go, Hef.
October of, was it 83? Was that the year?
She was Playmate of the Year for 83 and was Miss October 82, I think.
Right. And David Letterman asked her, isn't the Santa uncomfortable in this position?
Dave's got the centerfold open.
He's looking at it with her.
She's just like, yeah, what's up?
She's like, I didn't pick that pose.
I was trying to gather some information on her because she really hasn't been in any movies or anything.
No, not much.
Not much on her since then. I read a lot of comments about how she might be the best looking woman ever featured in the pages of Playboy magazine. And that is saying something.
Yeah, she's very good looking.
She's also on the cover of this album.
Yes.
That's her.
She's in the video, and she is the one taking off the lingerie on the cover of this album.
Meow.
Yep.
By the way, this song, Warren DeMartini had been working just kind of on the bus and just kind of around on tour.
Yep.
Demoed it in Hawaii, and when he played it for both the band and Bo Hill, Bo Hill was like, that's it. That's our single. That is it. And he said that when they were in the studio, Warren was a perfectionist with the guitar.
Yeah.
And he said he played the solo for the first time. So not only do you have this
killer
incredible
riff.
Hit song, he played the solo, which is amazing. Bo Hill's like, that's it, dude. We one take, that's it. And Warren DeMartini's like, no, I can do it better. I can do it better. And he did it like 5 or 6 more times. First one, he just nailed right out of the gate.
Yeah.
I love this song. I think it's one of the best songs of 1980. By the way, I'm going to give a shout out to my coworker, Mr. Mike Harmon.
Okay.
When he was in high school, he told me that there's a part where Stephen Piercy kind of whispers. In the video, he's actually whispering in her ear. He says, I know you only want romance. He says, I'll give you all that I can. But apparently at my friend's high school, misheard lyrics of all that I can. Great song. Love it.
Yeah. Fantastic. So this one hit number 40, right?
This was their second and last top 40 hit.
Right.
Hit number 40.
I'm surprised that Way Cool Jr. didn't hit the top 40.
Me too.
But I think it was time-wise maybe too late to the show. I
hate to leave this one too early, but next song on the album is called Give It All. Mm-hmm. Another great song.
Fantastic.
I mean, it's kind of like AC/DC. If you like one song, you're going to like all of them. It's just crunchy rock.
That literally is the exact thought that I had go through my head when I hit song number four on this one. I'm like, I feel like this is Back in Black, where all of the songs are kicking my butt in the exact same way.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, D, one of the lyrics in Give It All is, quote, "She came behind and then showed me her thighs." And I got to think this is straight from Police Academy, where Mahoney's behind the girl and he's like, "Come on, come on, show me the thighs."
What's your name, cadet?
Thompson, sir.
You live around here?
No, sir.
What's your telephone number, Thompson? Come on, eyes front, telephone number.
555-2467, sir.
Okay, let's see the thighs. Come on, come on, I haven't got all day, the thighs.
What in the hell are you doing?
Meeting women, sir.
I cannot believe that you just quoted Police Academy.
That is a Shirley movie we have to cover.
Bravo, sir. Bravo.
You know, they really pushed back. They didn't do a lot of power ballads. I mean, almost none.
Yeah.
In an era where a power ballad would sell a couple of million albums for you.
Yeah.
Now, we're going to talk about a song here in just a minute that I think might fill that role.
Okay.
But they resisted that urge.
So they, you know, they came up to L.A. and were very quickly doing well in the L.A. club scene. On the Sunset Strip, they were playing the Troubadour, they were playing the Whiskey, they're getting all of those shows in, and were very popular. They were selling places out, but they weren't getting signed. Like so many other bands of that time and that place were getting signed, and they weren't. So they ended up... They had a guy who recognized, hey, this is a band who's really good, and they're all really good looking, and I think I can make something of them. And this guy's name was Marshall Burrell. Now, we've talked about him before. Do you remember when we talked about him?
No.
I'll give you a hint. He discovered a band whose debut album came out in 1978, and he was their manager.
Van Halen.
You got it.
That's right. He brought Warner Brothers to Van Halen.
That is correct.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but he also may have had a hand in discovering the Beach Boys.
Oh, I don't know about that.
You don't know that story?
No.
Here you go. You ready for this?
Yeah, go for it.
Marshall Burrell began his career at the William Morris Agency, and in 1962... signed the Beach Boys to a long-term agency contract representing them from the start of their career through 1965. Brian Wilson was 20 years old when I met him, along with his brothers and father, Murray Wilson.
Wow. Wow. Talk about a guy who should have a Wikipedia page.
Right.
I mean, that's nuts. Signs the agency agreement for the Beach Boys, discovers Van Halen, then discovers Rat.
He also had a hand in CCR, I believe. Creedence Clearwater Revival.
Fantastic. So he produces some of their stuff on his independent label called Time Coast Music. Now, they had a single on that called You Think You're Tough.
Yes.
Have you seen the album cover for that?
I have.
It's got a pair of women's legs with rats climbing up and down them?
Yep.
Do you know whose legs those are?
That'd be Miss Tawny Catane.
You got it. Did we mention already that she was the girlfriend of Robin Crosby? Like high school sweethearts.
High school sweethearts.
Like, and I remember seeing interviews with her well past the Whitesnake days where she was like, he was my one true love. Like, she absolutely adored him.
She was tearing up while talking about him.
Okay, but You Think You're Tough wasn't actually their first single to get on a record. Do you know about this?
I want to say their first one maybe have been called Dr. Rock.
Tell the World.
Ooh, okay.
Tell the World, same 1982, same year that Warren DeMartini joins the band, they get on the compilation album called Metal Massacre, which we've talked about before.
Wow, okay.
And it's the first one, Metal Massacre 1. There's been a bunch of them since then. They were all unsigned bands, right? That's the whole album is unsigned bands. So Rat is on there with the song Tell the World. And last song in the album is by a band you might have heard of called Metallica, who was so unknown at that point that they misspelled their name the first time they pressed Metal Massacre Part 1.
I got to tell you my Lita Ford story.
Okay, yeah, tell me.
So, obviously, at this time, Motley Crue has blown up, okay? I mean, not blown up, but...
getting big.
people are looking for the next Motley Crue. Well, Rat's kind of in that succession, right?
Yep.
They're looking for the next Motley Crue. Here's Rat, but yet they remain unsigned. Stephen Pearcy is like, I don't really understand it. We're good. We can play, and we've got great songs. They just remained unsigned.
Right.
Okay? And now they've got Marshall Burl, who's managing them. He had a office at the Whiskey. They had become the house band for the Whiskey. And so now they're working in tandem. Well, he sets up this concert where it's going to be Rat and Lita Ford.
Okay.
Okay? And at the time, Lita Ford, she had been the guitarist for the Runaways.
Right.
Okay? So she was actually a name.
Cherry Bomb.
Go ahead. Yeah. Right? So this was July 27th, 1983. Okay? Yeah. Well, Lita was upset that she was going to be the first band, like the opener for Rat.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
She felt like, I'm a bigger name. They should open for me. And so she kind of staged a protest by not showing up on time. And so they're like waiting and waiting because she's their opener.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, when it's 45 minutes late. When's she going to show up? And they finally get to the point where they're like, well, screw her. We're going on. So they take the stage. Well, at the time, there were people there from Atlantic ready to sign.
This was the make or break show for them at the Beverly Wilshire.
That's right.
So they'd been unsigned for so long that they've just felt like this is our last hurrah. If we don't get signed on this one, we're not going anywhere.
So they blow the doors off. Lita shows up in the middle of their show and they're like, we're tough. We're on stage. Good luck, you know?
Right. See if anybody sticks around after, I guess.
That's right.
Yeah.
And the president of Atlantic, Doug Morris, comes up to him afterwards and says, how'd you like to be with Atlantic?
He was sitting with Marshall Burl at the table, and it wasn't until, I mean, they'd gone through several songs, but when they started playing Round and Round, he was like, sign them.
Done. All right, next song on the album. This song is called Closer to My Heart.
Okay, well, when hair metal bands say it's time for the rock ballad, they either pull out the piano or the 12-string guitar. And I'm guessing this is the one you're referring to with the ballad. This is the slowest song on the album, as far as I can tell. And you got Robin Crosby playing a beautiful 12-string guitar for the intro and kind of mix in with this song.
Yeah, I love this song. I think this one could have been a major hit if they had just released it.
Yeah.
With a video, you know, you think about the road video where guys looking out the window and
do black and white. Yeah. Have them boozing it up and being sad, and then girls.
Somebody
and then
carrying
happy.
You off stage.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. When you cross the line, you one step closer to my heart. Closer to my heart.
Like, them hanging the lingerie in the bus, that type
of
thing.
Oh, yeah. The Marshall Burl, I heard him talking about it. He was like, they started collecting things from every town that they went to. Mm-hmm. And by things, he meant lingerie and sex toys, which they hung off of the roof of the tour bus. At some point, Bobby Blotzer gets on the bus, and he's like, oh, it smells like a bar in here. And Marshall Burl was like, oh, the stink was funky.
Yeah, I heard Stephen Pearcy say that it got crabbed out. They had to fumigate the bus.
Don't sit there. Don't use a bathroom on the bus.
Oh, my gosh. The life of a rock star.
Yeah. So after Atlantic offers them the deal, they immediately get into the studio and start recording Out of the Cellar. Fantastic album.
There it is.
And who is that?
Tawny Kitaen.
Yeah, I can't see it from here. Anyway, yes, Tawny Kitaen, Robin's girlfriend, she's on the album cover and she's in the first video called Back for More. It's like her and a little girlfriend in a little sock hop, and then she goes to the jukebox and puts the record on, which goes, doesn't fit right, and finally plops down and Back for More starts playing. Now, you've got some great cameos in this one. Obviously, you got Tawny Kitaen.
Yes. Right?
You got Marshall Burrell, because a few minutes later, it seems like it's the same two girls, but they're dressed differently. But they seem to be schmoozing it up with some old businessman. Marshall Burrell is the old businessman.
Okay, okay.
And then, a little bit later on, just kind of a foreshadowing of what will come with Round and Round, at the end of the video, there's a guy on a motorcycle who, like, races into the club that they're playing at and wrecks the motorcycle. And when he takes the helmet off, it's Milton Burrell, who is Marshall Burrell's uncle, famed actor, comedian, did Uncle Milty, where he would dress and drag and stuff like that. But he's wrecked the motorcycle, and he's missing his two front teeth from the wreck. But there's one more cameo in it. They're all piled in a car. The girls, like a couple of the members of the band, come and steal the girls out of the sock hop or whatever, and they're riding around in this convertible car. Well, they get arrested for not paying the bill at the diner, and when they get pulled over, there are two cops, and when they take their helmet off, they get this long hair. You know who the two cops are?
No.
Nikki Sixx and Tommy Lee.
Really?
Yes. So there's always this talk of like a feud between these two bands, but I think these guys were buddies. Like, they would hang out and do blow and girls together. Absolutely. And, you know, and yeah, so they're featured in their first video.
Well, I mean, you talk about that in 1982. Mm-hmm. This is after Motley Crue has made their first album. Mm-hmm. 1982, this is pre-Shout at the Devil. Robin, Steven, Nikki, and Tommy almost formed their own band.
Oh, wow.
And if that happens, it goes a different direction. The what-ifs here are incredible.
Yeah. Well, and then another what-if is that Robin breaks up with Tawny Kitaen in 1984. We don't have the Jaguar Dance. We don't have the seductive looks driving down the highway.
Maybe that impacts Whitesnake's career.
Go check out our Whitesnake episode. Fantastic. Which we compared to Motley Crue.
That's right. Girls, yeah. Girls, Girls. Yeah. That was a lot of fun. All right. I do have one story for you on Stephen Piercy.
Yeah, go for it.
So Stephen Piercy, growing up, rambunctious, kind of troublemaker. Mm-hmm. But all he was interested in is like racing.
He wanted to be a Top Fuel racer. Do you know what those are? Okay, so you know in Parenthood, the Keanu Reeves, where he's like the drag car that's long. That's what Robin Piercy wanted to do. He wanted to be one of those drag racer with the, like, I mean, they accelerate faster than any other cars in the world.
Okay. So he wanted to race cars.
Yeah.
And had zero interest in music. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, he's riding his bike one day and gets hit by a car. And the car breaks his leg. He's in the hospital. He's laying in the hospital with a broken leg. And a friend brings in an acoustic guitar. And he's like, well, I'm just laying here. I might as well learn to play guitar, I guess.
Yeah.
And that is where it takes off. 1974, he's laying there in a hospital bed, starts strumming on that guitar.
The first show, somebody said, break a leg. And he said, I already did. I just made that up.
Hit stop on your tape player. Kick it out. Flip it over for side two. And we begin side two with a song called Between the Eyes.
So say what you will about Mike Reno or Mark Knopfler. There's only one guy who did the headband right, and that was Stephen Piercy.
He nailed it,
didn't
he?
I mean, he looks like a pirate, right? I mean, he's got it. He's got this long, flowy thing. He's got his long hair flowing over the other side, and he's wearing the frilly shirts. I mean, he looks like he could be playing the lead in Billy Budd. I mean, it's just, he's killing it.
You know, that was an intentional choice by them. They talked about how they would go to concerts, they see a bunch of guys, but they're like, hey, we want the girls, you know?
Yeah.
And so they became what they called fashion rock.
Fashion rock.
And they even, like, on their early flyers, it says Rat Fashion Rock.
What does that mean? That means we're wearing tight black leather pants. That's what that means.
And a cool headband. Right. So, you know, just to kind of backtrack a little bit, when we talk about the Out of the Cellar album, one of the songs from that album is a song called Lack of Communication. Now, that song was written at the last minute when Bo Hill's like, hey, we need another one. You know, we need another one.
Right.
And so Juan Crucier, who's the bass player, who had been in Dokken at one point, mm-hmm. he comes up with a song called Lack of Communication.
Okay.
And I thought this was kind of telling of how the band was run. So he knocks out this song. Well, it's a hit. Like, it goes on to become a hit. Mm-hmm. But when he gets in the studio, Steven is like totally reworking the lyrics. And one's like, dude, that's not how I wrote it. And that's, it doesn't even make sense what you're saying. And Steven says, look, dude, I'm the singer. I've got to be able to sell these lyrics. So sit over there and shut up. And one's like, well, at least make it make sense. You know, let's work on it. He said, Steven went up to him and took the lyrics and tore them in his face. One said, it was that moment that I knew I was going to have trouble with this guy.
Yeah. So it's interesting. You talk about that, you know, we need one more song. So after they did their Japan tour, Warren DeMartini gets home and he gets a call. Like, I mean, he's just walked in the door, like off the plane, in the door, and he gets a call from Dweezil Zappa. And he's like, hey, dude, love your stuff. Would you like to come over and play? And he's a huge Frank Zappa fan. Warren DeMartini is. And so he's like, yeah, sure. Like, what? When? What day you want to do it? And he's like, can you just come over right now? And he's like, now? Okay. Yeah. I mean, I've just been on a plane for 17 hours after a whirlwind tour, but sure.
Right.
And he was absolutely exhausted, but Frank was there. And Frank would later go on to say that his favorite contemporary guitarist is Warren DeMartini.
Whoa.
So, I mean, Frank Zappa's saying he's the best, that's pretty freaking incredible.
Yeah.
But while they're there, they're playing guitar together, which you would expect, right? Dweezil and Warren. And then Frank comes in and he shows Warren this kind of neat, it's basically like a warm-up scale, like a warm-up finger pattern to do. And so Warren, you know, adopts it, begins to play it. And then he's like, I feel like I'd use this in a song. And so on their fourth album, they switch producers because they didn't like Bo Hill, right?
Right.
So they went with Mike Stone, who had worked with Queen. So, you know, it's a pretty good shot, right?
Yeah.
Well, apparently, like, when the guy from Atlantic listened to the record, he called Bo Hill and he's like, hey, I just got the dad on this. And he's like, oh, how'd it sound? Sounds like they're a hotel band. It's awful.
Right.
And so they go back to Bo Hill. Now, Mike Stone had heard this song that Warren DeMartini had put this scale that he had learned from Frank Zappa in, and he was like, eh, put that away. We don't really need that. It's not going to be that good. And so they go to Bo Hill. They remix the album. They get everything together. And again, it's that we need one more song. And so he's like, well, I got this song that Mike said I should put in the box, but if we don't have one, we don't have one. And he's like, yeah, play it for me. And he plays him the song, and he's like, what's that called? And he's like, I was thinking something like Way Cool Junior. So if you listen to Way Cool Junior, I'll pull that up real quick.
Yeah.
What makes him so special?
How about that?
Isn't that crazy?
That's fantastic.
So that little lick is something Frank Zappa taught Warren DeMartini before they were ever anybody, and he just incorporated it into their fourth album.
That's fantastic. And to me, Way Cool Junior is absolutely one of their best top three songs.
It's fantastic. And that little riff makes an otherwise just kind of standard blues song into something very special.
I got something for you on that song.
Okay.
So at the very beginning, you have this clickety, click, click, clickety, click, click, click.
Yeah.
Well, Bo Hill was like, this song needs something else. It needs something. It needs something. So he turned to his second engineer. And he's like, go to the drugstore, get me 10 thimbles. And when he came back, he put the thimbles on his fingers, and he said it was on a hard surface, and it's like, click, 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 click. That's Bo Hill playing thimbles on a table.
Fantastic.
So
I love it.
Way Cool Junior, great song.
Yeah.
Okay. Next song in the album is a song called What You Give Is What You Get. Okay. This is one of the strongest songs on the album. I think this is like next tier under You're in Love and Lay It Down.
It's got a great use of the phrase, what you give is what you get.
Yeah.
I mean, taking that and making it a song that works is a tough sell, and they did a great job with it.
Yeah. I think it's underrated. I don't hear it a lot, but it's a good song. I think at this point, we need to talk about Robin Crosby.
Okay. Robin Crosby. So when he was a kid, his dad was a chemistry teacher until he was about 8 years old. And then his dad gets asked to be a photographer to illustrate the book called The Call to California. And it was like California Commission was commissioning this book.
Yeah.
And it was commemorating the California Bicentennial. And so his dad, Harry W. Crosby, got a pack mule and followed the route of the Portola Expedition of 1769 to make photographs to illustrate this book. And it was, I mean, he went 600 miles.
On a pack mule.
He was on the back of a mule.
Wow. For
600 miles to illustrate this book. And he ended up doing, like, he did like four more books, the last of which, oddly, you just run into these things, was published by the University of Oklahoma Press back in like 1994 or something. He just passed away last year at the age of 98. Obviously, significantly outlived his son, who has an incredibly tragic story.
So Robin Crosby, as we've said, 6'5", I mean, built like a linebacker or like a power-hitting third baseman, grew up playing baseball,
yep.
Was a big baseball player, fell in love with the guitar, and of course, grabbed Tawny Kitaen and shot for the moon, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And over the time, you know, they called him King. He was their leader.
Yeah.
And Bo Hill said he was the glue to the band. He was the one. When Bo Hill was finishing up the mixing, you guys can leave the studio as long as I can call whoever and they can be ready to come in and help me with the mixing. He said he always called Robin because Robin's the most level-headed, most easygoing, the most reasonable person to work with. Well, later on, at like the Reach for the Sky tour, Juan Croucier starts noticing. He's like, man, who keeps throwing up in our dressing room bathroom? Like, what the heck is going on here?
Yeah.
Well, nobody knew because he hit it so well. Robin Crosby had a very serious heroin addiction.
Yeah.
That was getting out of control.
Yeah. I mean, and got out of control.
He said he had a $500 a day habit.
Which you can sustain if you're topping the charts, but they weren't always topping the charts. And so ultimately it led to him losing all of his money. Yeah, I heard him talking about this, and he said, telling me to stop heroin was like telling me to stop breathing.
Yeah.
Like, it's that easy to do.
When he got kicked out of the band, he went to rehab. When he came back, he tried to join the band, and they're like, okay, well, let's see what you got, and he couldn't play.
Yeah, and what led to him getting kicked out the first time, they were struggling to regain their footing that they had lost, did a show in Japan, and I mean, it's this simple. He grabbed the wrong guitar. Like, guitarists, you know, you're like, how much difference can it make? Well, the difference is you will tune it differently. Like, sometimes you have a song, you're just going to tune the guitar a half step or a full step down. Well, he grabs the wrong guitar for a song, which means he's trying to play it in a key half a step different than everyone else in the band is playing it. And it just sounds, it's just nails against the chalkboard. It's the Jaws theme to make you feel uncomfortable, right? I mean, it's right. Just at some point, every member of the band was looking at him because he just didn't even realize he was the only one who didn't know. Every member of the audience was looking at him and they're just like, this is just not good work.
So they kicked him out, tried to come back. Like, he got out of rehab, really were kind of hoping that he could regain it. You know, he wanted a chance to redeem himself, but he couldn't play.
Mm-hmm.
And so Stephen Pearcy is like, he can't, it's not happening.
Yeah.
And so he lost his fame. He lost his band. He lost his fortune.
Lost his wife.
He lost his wife.
By the way, he did okay after Tawny Kitaen.
He did.
He married, what was her name? Lori Carr.
Lori Carr.
1987, who was the year before Playmate of the Month in December 1986.
Yeah, and if you're wondering if I've ever seen her before, if you have the Slaughter album, Stick It to You, she is the one on the cover there.
I was hoping to blow your mind with that little tidbit, and you already knew it. Good job,
when
you.
It comes to Playmates, I know my stuff. So he lost everything, and on top of that, he contracted HIV.
Yeah.
Which became full-blown AIDS.
I mean, it was reported that he had died of AIDS when he passed in 2002 at only 42 years old. And I remember Nikki Sixx talking about it in the Heroin Diaries about just how devastating all of that was. But it was not AIDS that killed him.
He took one last mega booster shot of heroin.
Yeah, he's going to die doing the thing he's loved more than anything else in the world.
By the way, you know, in Heroin Diaries, Dickie Six gave him a shot and said, look, you come with me, you live clean, and you can stay here. And he couldn't.
Couldn't do it.
And he had to kick him out. We're talking about he had to borrow $20 from these guys, you know, like he would beg Juan Crucier, just give me $20.
Yeah.
And he had sores on his feet. I mean, just terrible. He lived in a shack. Just the worst of the worst.
Yeah.
By the way, for a happier story, I sent you a little trivia note yesterday. Name the soundtrack that included contributions from Elton John, Jeff Beck, Robin Crosby. You're like, I don't really know. Young Guns 2 soundtrack, the John Bon Jovi Blaze of Glory.
Wow.
Robin Crosby played on that album.
Nice. Well, Rat had Bon Jovi open for them in this tour, didn't they? The Invasion of Privacy tour, right?
Yes. Bon Jovi.
This was 1 year before Slippery When Wet came out.
This is the 7,800 degrees Fahrenheit. Wow. Bon Jovi.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Okay. Next song on the album?
Yep.
Song called Got Me on the Line.
Hello?
They're consistent.
Yep.
It's a pumping rocker.
You like the first one, you're going to like this one.
That's right. I don't think this one is particularly special, but it's Rat.
Right. It's got the same sound. If you love the sound, you're going to love it. To me, it is. If there's a filler song on this one, it's probably this song.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to talk to you just for a moment. We haven't really got to their signature song as much.
Uh-huh.
The song Round and Round blew up in 1984.
Absolutely, yeah.
One of the cool things about that was the music video. Mm-hmm. That you have this rock band, and basically they're invading a dinner party, and they're coming through the ceiling and through the walls, and you have all these, you know, uppity people who are trying to have a dinner party. Well, it stars Milton Berle.
Milton Berle is Uncle Milty and is doing the drag thing.
He plays the husband, he plays the wife, and the guys had a great time with him during this filming of this video.
Yeah.
And they said they would ask him tons of questions about the old days. And Stephen Piercy said, the only thing I wanted to know is, Milton, did you nail Marilyn Monroe? And he said, of course. Of course I did. Which they thought was hilarious. But the interesting thing, so that became heavy rotation in MTV.
Uh-huh.
Sold a ton of albums for them. Funny video, but great song as well. You still hear it on the radio today.
Yeah.
When they went in the studio to record Out of the Cellar, everybody was dead broke, like zero income on their tax returns.
Right.
When they returned from the Out of the Cellar tour, $1.2 million is what each of them were worth.
Each. Pretty impressive.
They went from having absolutely nothing to being filthy rich.
I'll tell you what I love about that song. I mean, I love the whole song. It's fantastic.
Sure, sure.
It's got staying power. It's Ear Candy, all of that stuff. But the solo that they have in that song, it's both of them playing at the same time. Like it's like the end of Hotel California where Don Felder and Joe Walsh are like back and forth, but then also at the very end playing riffs that are on top of each other. And it's absolutely fantastic. Yeah.
Love it. Okay. Next song on the album, song called You Should Know By Now. Okay, another kind of filler song for me.
Yeah, I do want to mention, you know, like to be a fantastic band, especially a fantastic hair metal band, you have to have a drummer who really drives through the show. Like, bang the gongs hard, baby. I mean, he's got to hit hard. He's got to be good. He's got to be great at his fills. And Bobby Blotzer does all of that. Like, he's kind of the guy in the back that you don't think about that much, but he really is an incredible drummer. I saw, I think you may have sent it to me, Don Dokken talking about how he was, you know, at his house, he and the band, that he had at the time. Who he had, I think it was, what was it,
Airborne,
right. Had been Airborne for a while, and then another band became Airborne, and they couldn't do that anymore, so he just called it Dokken as just kind of a placeholder.
Right.
Right, and he's like, it rhymes with rockin', you know, we'll figure out something else later on. But anyway, when they're still nobodies, just playing at somebody's house,
right.
He said they would do it for 45 minutes, and then they'd stop because the cops would show up, and then they'd wait 45 minutes. And they play for another 45 minutes before the cops showed up again.
Right.
It's like, you just timed it right. You didn't get into much trouble. But he says one day they're playing and they're set, and the pizza delivery guy comes, and he's like, oh, you guys playing? He's like, yeah. He goes, I play drums. He's like, have a seat, man. Let's see what you can do. He gets in, plays. Next week, he's with the band.
That's crazy.
And that pizza delivery guy was Bobby Blotzer.
Bobby Blotzer.
So Bobby Blotzer is in Dokken with Juan Cruchier, who's playing the bass.
Right.
And as you mentioned, Warren DeMartini was a part of the band.
Right.
So that's three out of the five members of the band.
Yep.
And I bet Stephen Piercy and Robin Crosby probably hung out and played the Dokken a little bit at some point.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Of course. It's pretty amazing. You know, I've got a little tidbit for you. I don't know if you know this fact or not, but Rat came out with all these crunchy rockers, but they also had a couple of songs on soundtracks. Mm. Now, neither one of these we've covered, but I'm wondering if maybe next year's the year for one of these. So
okay.
They had a song called Body Talk on The Golden Child.
Okay.
Remember The Golden Child with Eddie Murphy?
I do. Yeah, keep going.
Okay. So Body Talk, familiar song. I bet you've heard it.
Okay.
And then they had a song called Nobody Rides for Free. Maybe their last truly great song off of the Point Break soundtrack.
Ah, yes. Okay. Yeah. Nice. No, so that's a good one.
I love Point Break.
So I've told stories about every member of the band now, except for Juan Cruchier.
Yeah.
All I've got on him, and this is actually kind of impressive, he played with Quiet Riot as their bassist right before Randy Rhoads, like with Randy Rhoads before Randy Rhoads left to go play with Ozzy Osbourne. So take that story full circle from what we learned before about Jake Ely and all that.
We've talked about Dokken. We've talked about Rat. We've talked about Ozzy. We've talked about Quiet Riot. Mark Torian from Bullet Boys was in Rat, I think, for a moment.
I have got a Jimi Hendrix Scorpions connection that's going to blow your mind that I'll tell you on the next song.
Oh, okay. Well, let's get to it then.
Okay.
Last song on the album. This song is called Dangerous But Worth the Risk. Okay, guess which song opened every concert on the Invasion of Your Privacy tour?
Is it Dangerous But Worth the Risk?
Dangerous But Worth the Risk.
It's a great song to check the sound levels with, honestly. I mean, I know that they do that before every show anyway, but like you've got such a deep bass on the guitar on this one. I haven't looked it up, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was a drop tuning somehow. But that, I mean, it's very deep, full, fat bass sound for the guitar. Love it.
I think this should have been the title for the album.
Oh, that could have been a great one.
Invasion of Your Privacy, we're like, what does that mean? You and I both are like, we didn't really come up with anything.
Not really good title.
Dangerous but Worth the Risk?
That's a great one.
I think so. Tell me the story. I'm dying to hear it.
Okay. So Scorpion's first album, Lonesome Crow.
Okay.
Okay, came out in 1972.
Right.
All right?
Yeah.
So the story goes, on like the first pressing of the album, you know, the first when they released so many of them, in the liner notes, in kind of the small print, they had a phone number on there.
Oh, cool.
And it's like, oh, is this the phone number to the publisher, the production company, the studio, what it is, you know? And so these kids in San Diego notice, it's the kids, they might have been adults, I don't know. They notice this phone number, but it's German. And this is the 70s, 80s.
It's like $12 a minute.
Right, exactly. Like, it's nuts. Like, right. It's ridiculous. Like, you could not call. And so, but they're just like, you know what? They were squatting in a house that somebody else was paying the phone bill. Like it was some, you know, some rich place where they had just left the phone on to go vacation and wherever.
Right.
And they're squatting in this house. And so they decide to try to call this number thinking they're going to get the studio. Rudy Shankar answers the phone.
What? No way.
They put Rudy Shankar's phone number on the album. Right. And so the guy just BS's Rudy Shankar for like 10 minutes, you know, and is trying to convince him that he has got this invention that he has that will change the way the guitar is played, and he really needs Uli Roth's phone number. And after 10 minutes, Rudy Shankar is like, all right, yeah, here's the phone number, and gives him Uli Roth's phone number.
Okay, yeah.
So fast forward a few years, Warren DeMartini is in high school with his buddies, and they've got this story, and he's like, whatever, this is not real. And they're like, here's Uli Roth's phone number.
Yeah.
And so he tries it, and it never goes through.
Okay.
And he's like, what am I thinking? I'm in L.A. He's in Germany. There's a total time difference here. So he, like, does the math, and he's like, okay, so he's in a band. He's going to wake up around noon.
Right.
I will try to call him as soon as he wakes up, which will be 3 a.m. here. And so every time his buddies got together, he would try to make this phone call. And every time it just didn't get through. And then finally, one night, he makes the phone call and a woman answers the phone. The woman who answers the phone is Monica Daneman.
Okay.
Does that name anything to you?
Nope.
Okay. Monica Daneman was the one with Jimi Hendrix whenever he died.
Oh, wow. What?
She later got involved in a relationship with Uli Roth. Now, she was the subject of a lot of allegations that she was somehow connected to Jimi Hendrix dying, which she fought about a lot. And, like, at some point, like, she had been prohibited from calling somebody a liar for talking about her being a part of his death. And she did it again, even though she wasn't supposed to. And, like, they filed a lawsuit against her, and, like, a couple days later, they found her dead in a car with, like, carbon monoxide. Ruled a suicide. Uli Roth, to this day, says he thinks that there was foul play involved. But anyway, Warren DeMartini convinces Monica Daneman that he needs to talk to Uli Roth. And so, lo and behold, Uli is like, hello? And he's like, hi. And all his buddies are like, say something.
Right,
say something.
Right,
he's
right.
Like, so what kind of picks do you use?
Oh,
you know,
my
just
gosh.
Like, and he stammers around for a while, but eventually he actually, like, kind of gets out of it, and he starts talking to him about amps and tubes and what kind of stuff, and like comparing equipment, even though he's just this high school kid who's just really learning to play the guitar, you know. He talks to Uli Roth. So fast forward 10, 15 years later.
Yeah, yeah.
Uli is playing at the House of Blues. Warren DeMartini is in town, and he's like, I'll give him a call.
Yeah.
And then he shows up to, and he's like, Uli, Warren DeMartini, I'm sure there's no way that you remember this. You remember getting a call from a high school kid in the United States back in the 70s?
Yeah.
And Uli Roth's like, who are you? He's like, Warren what? DeMartini. Oh, yes, I remember you. And so even though, I mean, I guess it's a pretty random experience to get.
Right.
I mean, imagine getting a call from somebody in Indonesia at noon, yeah, and they want to talk about the podcast.
Right.
Like, you'd remember that 15 years
I definitely would.
On, right? And so, yeah. So
call us, you know.
Yeah. Uli Roth got a call from a young high school Warren DeMartini.
That's a great story.
From a phone number. On their first album.
You know, Warren blew an opportunity to ask him if the song was written by the CIA or not. I was dying to talk about that album at some
point. Yeah, that was 20-something years later, but yeah.
That's crazy. By the way, I remember when I was in high school, the Van Halen For Unlawful Carnal Knowledge album came out.
Mm-hmm.
And in the pictures in the insert of the CD, there was a telephone number there as well. And I know people were wearing it out. They had to change the number. So,
all right.
So if you're an aspiring person in a band, don't put your telephone number anywhere that it can be found.
It's hilarious. Okay. So that does it for Rat. Next week we have Dokken
Under Lock and Key next week. It's not love that left you cold. It's not love.
So, like we've talked about, there's a lot of overlap here, and these bands are also very similar in the fact that they have had a ton of infighting that led to the demise of the band. But I think Dokken may have Rat Beat in this category.
It's going to be amazing. I heard Don Dokken say, "The last time I talked to George Lynch, his hands were around my neck and he was trying to choke me."
So be sure to tune in for that episode next week. Thank you guys so much for checking us out. If you want to contribute financially, go check us out on patreon.com/Shirley Podcast. You can join and get all of our one-hit wonder episodes that are just for our Patreon members for as little as $5 a month. Appreciate you guys. Thank you for tuning in, and we will see you next week.
Bye, guys.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.